Dr. Hoffman here. This Intelligent Medicine podcast is brought to you by Super Beets. I personally take Super Beets when I need a power boost. It's my favorite product. Super Beets gives me energy and stamina for my busy day. Right now, get a one-month supply free with your first order. Check out the Dr. Hoffman special right now at IntelligentBeets.com. That's IntelligentBeets.com. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today's subject I think is quite fascinating because I, as a person interested in exercise, and you as, well, depends on where you're on the spectrum, whether you're sedentary, whether you're a sporadic exerciser, a weekend warrior, a true fitness buff, or a professional or amateur athlete, sports supplements are probably the biggest single category of supplements sold across the United States, and there's some questions as to the efficacy of these supplements. Are consumers wasting their money, or are some supplements the real deal? What about diet? What's the ideal diet for athleticism? Is carbo-loading still in vogue? We're going to talk to a professional. Our guest today is Tavis Piattoli. He is the sports dietitian for the New Orleans Pelicans, and he is the former sports dietitian for the New Orleans Saints from 2006 to 2013. He is also at Tulane University Athletics and at the NFLPA Brain and Body Trust Program at Tulane's Institute of Sports Medicine. He is someone who has formed a website which involves a team approach to blogging and getting the word out. Please give us the specifications. First of all, welcome to Intelligent Medicine, Tavis. It's mysportsdconnect.com, correct?
Yes, sir. Thanks for having me. And it is. It's mysportsdconnect. Yes, sir.
Okay. And that's a resource where there's all kinds of information about sports nutrition. And I guess it's called mysportsdconnect because that would be the D stands for diet. MySportsDConnect. Okay,
yeah,
or dietitian.
It's called MySportsDietitian, yes, and everything is done for young athletes, high school and college athletes.
Okay, because my URL that I put in is MySportsDConnect, but you'll also connect via MySportsDietitian?
MySportsD.com or MySportsDConnect.com.
Okay, great. Sometimes people own multiple domains, so that's why that happens. You've got to corner the market on all the names.
We tried to get the other one, but someone already had it.
Somebody nailed that one down. Yeah, that happens.
Yeah.
So, okay, great. Well, let's start with a kind of a fundamental question, which is, you know, there's a profusion of supplements. There's amazing claims about supplements continuously. You're going to go to health food stores, GNC, Vitamin Shop, and, you know, various sports emporia, and you're going to see these huge vats, I mean, these gigantic bottles of powders and potions and things that are supposed to make your performance explode. So, you know, how do consumers sort their way through this maze of claims? And are some of these things the real deal, or, I mean, what's going on with that?
It's a great question, and it really is. It's intimidating for a lot of people to walk into a supplement store and really get an idea of what works, you know, what's the bright brand, because it's like almost like a food store. It's so big. There's so many options. And I would say, if I had to really give you a decent number, 90% of the people just really don't know, you know, what goes into making a dietary supplement. Because really, to start from scratch, you know, there's manufacturers, and there's a lot of manufacturers in the industry. And there are good manufacturers that really do a good job. And what does that mean is, you know, there are manufacturers that will get a double NSF certification for the facility, meaning they get certified to handle all the raw materials that come in, and it's inspected to make sure there's no illegal substances in it. Then they also become what's called athletic.
Excuse me, when you say illegal supplement substances, in other words, things that might disqualify an athlete, and that's there actually been several instances where athletes have been found to test positive with the urine or blood with some banned substance, and then they blame it on the supplements. They, you know, which may be disingenuous, or it may be true in some cases. Maybe really they did take a supplement that was tainted, a poor quality supplement, but you never know. Maybe they were just using that as an excuse, and they were actually intentionally shooting something up.
They could. They could have taken something, but at the same time, professional and college athletes are, they're instructed on what to look for, and I guess we'll talk about that at some point when, you know, we talk about certification components for supplements, because
sure.
you know, the some manufacturers, you know, they do a really good job of housing the raw materials, and they buy from good suppliers to where they know they're getting clean ingredients. And then there's other manufacturers that, you know, they don't clean their machines in between running different products. You know, they don't handle the raw material safely. So there is a chance for contamination. And that's how some of these protein powders get contaminated. So, for example, if I'm a manufacturer, I may be running a product that has a banned substance in it called synephrine. Synephrine is banned by the NFL and Major League Baseball.
Right. But illegal over the counter, right? Isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's legal to use. There's several supplements that have it in it.
Yeah.
You know, it's primarily used as a stimulant and weight loss aid. Mm-hmm. So let's just say somebody doesn't clean their machine and there's still traces of synephrine,
right.
or maybe even steroids in their product, and then they run another protein powder that company does not want that product in. It could get in there.
Right.
And then that's how some of these guys may be testing positive for things. But at the same time, the NFL, you know, there are sports dietitians that work with teams, there are athletic trainers, strength coaches. These guys know what products are certified. The majority of these guys should be given a list and instructed. Here are all the things that are banned by the NFL. Some teams that don't have a sports dietitian, they may lack right. that advantage to have that education for those guys.
But I'm going to tell you up front, though, that the vast majority of people listening to this podcast, some will be professional athletes, college athletes, and so we're subject to the testing, but the vast majority of people listening to this podcast are people who are going to say, I don't care what's in it. You know, I just wanted to enhance my performance, you know, be it DHEA, you know, which is a hormone, or, you know, synephrine, or, you know, massive doses of some kind of nitric oxide releaser, or you name it, they'll take it.
No, absolutely. You're right. People are just looking for, you know, what's good. And it's really hard when you walk into a store because, you know, the person that works behind the counter of a supplement store, they lack the education. I've seen that in a lot of the kids that I've worked with some of the stuff that they've brought to me. I've seen that in my adult clients, mm-hmm. that it's the people behind the counter that you really have to be concerned yep. about. And I'll give you a case study. I had a 14-year-old athlete who had 4 catheter ablations to correct an abnormal rhythm on his heart. He had supraventricular tachycardia. And so they corrected his rhythm, and then he was just suffering from fatigue. And this was before I had a chance to meet with him and look at his diet. Well, he walked into a supplement store with his parents. His parents told them he had SVT, and then they still gave him a supplement that had synephrine, caffeine,
Ooh.
And guarana seed, 3 stimulants.
Wow.
And I'm just like, wow, this is really scary. So mm-hmm. the people behind the counter really... You know,
well, maybe they just thought SVT was like a fraternity house or something. Well, they didn't know what that was.
He had a surgery to correct his heart rhythm.
Okay. Okay, so they were real clear about that.
Yeah, yeah. They were said, you know, here's the information. So it's really scary that, you know, because they're not pharmacists, they're not nutritionists, they're not
yeah.
dietitians. They're just people looking to make an extra income, mm-hmm. as well as they get paid based on commission.
Yeah.
So it's a little scary that what's out there. So it's very difficult for the consumer to know, you know, is this brand I'm taking? Do they use the right raw materials? Do they use mm-hmm. the right bioavailable form? And I'll just use, like, fish oil, for example. Fish oil is something that a lot of people are recommending. There's a lot of good science. I
mm-hmm.
just spoke with one of the leading fish oil experts yesterday at a conference in Atlanta. And
by the way, you yourself do podcasts. You actually, why don't you let our listeners know about that?
Sure. Yeah, actually, if you go to mysportsdeconnect.com and you click on podcast, mm-hmm. You'll see, you know, we have what's called the Next Level Podcast, because our goal is to try to get athletes to the next level. And, you know, primarily what you're going to see is a lot of the colleagues in my industry, sports dietitians, we have them come on and talk about, you know, nutrition for wrestling, nutrition for any typical sport. I've had a couple of pro athletes, like Blake Griffin from the Clippers was on the show.
Oh, yeah, Blake.
Several months
mm-hmm.
back.
Yeah.
And so just, you know, really trying to, similar to what you're doing, but more focused just on the nutrition component mm-hmm. for athletes and individuals.
Okay. So intelligent sports medicine, sort of.
Absolutely.
to paraphrase the name of this show, Intelligent Medicine. All right, great. So, a fundamental question is, you know, before we get to diet, because I do want to get to diet, because we tend to focus on, you know, what pills you're taking. It's not all about
sure.
pills. Diet's the fundamental foundation for athletic performance. But why do athletes take supplements, and are they really essential, or, you know, do they make a difference, or are they just hype?
Yeah, that's a great question, too, is the young athletes, number one, they steer towards the supplements, and that young athlete I'm defining as between 13 and 18. they're tending to look for supplements because they're doing two things incorrectly. They're not eating well, and they're not getting sufficient calories, and they're working out too much. And I particularly focus on some of these young athletes that are trying to gain weight. So they don't see the results. They're not getting stronger. They're not seeing the scale move. They're not seeing themselves build muscle. So they think, let me take supplements, because the end result is they want to get bigger, they want to get faster, and they want to get stronger. Mm-hmm. That's in the research we did with Louisiana athletes, we surveyed 25,000 high school kids, and those were really the top three reasons they wanted to take supplements. So those are the reasons, because, you know, in one of the questions we asked, would you take something harmful to your body if it meant you can get a college scholarship? And about 40%...
Hell yeah! Is the answer, right?
It said yeah.
Hell yeah!
Like, why not?
Yeah.
So, you know, I want to say about 6% of young athletes are taking steroids. I think, you know, the Taylor Hooten Foundation
wow.
did a great job with research on that. And I think it's like 1 in 16 kids at the high school.
That's so terrible for young developing bodies. That's and minds.
Yeah.
It's horrible. Horrible.
And really at the pro level, some of these guys, you know, they're just doing it to keep their bodies from healing faster or to help their body heal faster.
Yes,
or
yes.
To recover a little faster. Because some of these guys have their diets down when they
yeah.
get a little bit older. They've gone through education.
Right.
But now they're like, what else can give me in a performance advantage to where I'm not as sore for 3 days, now I'm maybe sore for a day and
right.
a half.
And that actually is the rationale to some extent for the use of growth hormone and testosterone and other banned substances, is not to make you huge, although it can really help you in the weight room, but also these substances actually have therapeutic value in promoting healing. And I think that's one of the downsides, the unfortunate aspect of all these sports scandals, is that we're tainting these substances, which, you know, we can decide whether we want to have them in sports or not. That's a decision about, you know, how we want to view our athletes. But when it comes to medicine, these substances actually have fascinating healing properties, which, you know, should not be put down because athletes cheat using these substances.
I agree. I mean, I think, you know, I agree to the point where you said people are using them not just to get big and strong. They're looking at it from the healing and recovery process.
Mm-hmm.
If someone's down 8 weeks or 12 months or whatever, and they say, hey, if I cut that in half and growth hormone does it,
yeah, I mean,
why not try it?
So, I mean, someone with, like, you know, an older man who's suffering from low testosterone gets a broken hip, their chances of dying are very high, and they might have potential for becoming stronger and more rapid healing if they were to take that. And, you know, it's unfortunate that that gets lost in the controversy. Okay,
right.
So, but we're not talking necessarily about hormones. We're talking about supplements. And, you know, there is this myth that, especially among kids and bodybuilders, that, you know, if you take these big vats of protein, that somehow this will magically jump into your muscle and your muscles will just, you know, become huge. True or false?
False. Yeah, protein is it's kind of misunderstood. You know, I think it's still believed as if, you know, at the young level or even athletes, if I eat protein, I get bigger and I gain weight, and it's actually not the case. The research is pretty solid now that we don't need enormous amounts of protein. We need, number one, we need to spread protein out throughout the day. They showed that if you eat protein in 5 to 6 smaller meals, that may be 20 to 30 grams per meal or 40 grams depending on your size, you know, and you don't eat that one big bolus dose at the end of the day, your body's net protein balance is higher than if you just eat 2 or 3 big meals with protein.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, that's one component of the protein. Protein is not dangerous, though. If you have a healthy kidney, if your body, you know, has no side effects, you know, your kidney is fine, excessive amounts of protein or higher doses of protein is not going to cause any harm. Now, what we don't know is if a young kid, 14 or 18, uses, you know, excessive amounts for a year, we don't really know what happens because there's not a lot of data mm-hmm. to really show that. My guess would be nothing, but, you know, we haven't really seen anything yet.
Well, give us some ranges, because I think that the guidelines for protein for the average male who's not necessarily involved in strength training or bodybuilding is, what, 70, 90 grams of protein per day. Am I close to the... however, many athletes they're encouraged to take 300 grams of protein a day. And there is some rationale, I think, for taking more protein, because if you're having a lot of muscle breakdown due to strenuous exercise, you may need a little more protein to repair your muscles. There is something to that. But, you know, where's the outer limits of that?
Sure. I think the RDA for protein is really too low, because protein has so many benefits, not just from a muscle growth and recovery standpoint, but from possibly a weight loss, a thermogenic point.
Satiety to help you not crave carbs.
Hormonal, immune. So there's so many benefits for protein. But, you know, typically I recommend, I look at each individual differently when I look at their needs. And, you know, I go at the probably the most anywhere from about 1.8 to 2.2 grams per kilogram of body weight, or anywhere from like 0.8 to 1 gram per pound. That would be the ceiling that I would go to. Anything more than that has not been shown to be beneficial when it comes to getting bigger.
So let's translate. You know, a 100-kilogram athlete would be, you know, a pretty powerfully built running back, you know, 220. How much protein should they be taking in?
You're looking at somewhere between 180 and 220 grams of protein.
Okay. Well, that's reasonable.
Because some of these individuals need, you know, 5,000-6,000 calories. So, we you know, I don't like to overload them all throughout the day with carbohydrate. You know, I try to focus carbohydrate to be around their workouts, and then we do more protein and fat when they're less, you know, when they're less active throughout the day.
So now, you know, you've introduced the term carbohydrates. A lot of people on very low carbohydrate diets. Is there a place for a very low carbohydrate diet in, say, an endurance athlete or in a strength training athlete, or is that misguided?
Yeah, you know, it's great to really. I'm glad you brought that up, because the high fat, low carb diet in the endurance population, it's so new. You know, we're looking at the stuff from Tim Noakes, Jeff Volek,
which is sort of the opposite of carbo loading, the trend from the 70s.
We're seeing these ultra-endurance athletes now. Some of these guys are testing this high-fat, low-carb approach to see tapping, so getting into ketosis and then tapping into their fat stores to use as fuel, because we only have about 2 to 2,500 calories of carbs available, but we have over 100,000 calories.
In other words, it's stored as glycogen in the liver and in the muscles, so there's a limit, and then you hit the so-called wall, you bunk,
right,
and your legs become rubbery, and you slow down, and that's it.
But what we're seeing is some of these individuals, again, it's all case study based right now. There's no true literature that says there's a performance benefit. Is these individuals are adapting to it. They're becoming what's called fat adapted or keto adapted, to where they follow a very low carbohydrate, 20 to 50 grams a day, for about 8 weeks. And once they become adapted and used to that, and they're training at a high not a high volume, but they're training at a high level, to where they might be running 20, 30, 40, maybe 50 miles. And that is pretty high volume. But then they're becoming so adapted, they're eventually tapping into their fat stores. What the typical endurance athlete does is, once they start to feel they're getting weak or they're tired, they put in a gel or they put in a simple carbohydrate,
right,
so they never really get
Gatorade or whatnot, electrolyte drink,
yeah,
you know, with sugar.
So just a fast-acting sugar that really prevents them from getting to their fat stores. So it's a different approach. We just don't have any science to really say, hey, let's do this. I mean, you know, I think Dr. Jeff Volek's lab, when he was with UConn, he's now with Ohio State, they did a study on that. It hasn't been published yet. I don't know the results, but it'll be interesting to see the performance side. I think from what I saw from a few individuals that were in the study, they had them run for 3 hours. So we'll see if there were any performance benefits from trying to become keto adaptive.
There's also been some buzz around the paleo diet for athletes. In fact, there's a book by Lauren Cordain and the guy who came up with the anaerobic threshold concept. What was his name? They collaborated on a book called The Paleo Diet for Athletes. Any potential benefits of that? Because after all, you're eliminating some foods which might put a drag on the body in susceptible individuals. They might be having hidden low-grade allergies to, say, gluten or dairy or other foods that are modern foods, and you might enhance your athletic performance with this type of diet.
Yeah, I think you have to look at everybody's individual needs completely individually, because, you know, that might work for some people. I don't endorse any one approach, because there's no one approach that works best for everybody. Where the paleo can be beneficial, I mean, I think some people think paleo is low carb, but it's not really. I mean,
no, not necessarily.
It's basically just kind of like I don't want to say a clean eating approach, but it's just it's lean protein, it's gluten-free carbohydrates or gluten-free starches, you know, and really it's more veggies.
Yep.
So, you know, it has benefits. I mean, I think there's been some articles on certain teams, like NBA teams, using a paleo diet approach, but people look at it and think, oh, they're low-carbing, and they're really not. I mean, you know, if your diet's loaded with rice and potatoes and gluten-free carbs, and you have a true gluten allergy or you're celiac, then yeah, that probably yeah. will work for you. If you don't have
who's the tennis player who says he achieved some benefits with a gluten-free diet? I forget.
I think it was. I can see his face right now.
Right.
Djokovic.
Djokovic. Yes. Yes. Yeah. The guy who's always up in the top five, and competing for.
Typically, when we see that, it's what happens is these are people that are eating a ton of junk anyway, and I'm not saying he was before, but you know, you look at a lot of the basketball guys. They were consuming so much sugar before, and then they switched to this type of lifestyle, and they're like, "Hey, I feel better." Well, of course you do. If anybody was eating McDonald's all day and then they go to a paleo, they're going to feel better. So, you know, a lot of people write diet books to make money. I mean, but some people, there is a legitimate approach. But I don't like to label anything. We look at a way to change someone's diet depending on what they're doing. If they're drinking too much soda, we try to, you know, reduce that. If they're eating too much fast food, we try to reduce that. It's just look at any typical way we can make something a little bit better with that individual's diet without putting a label on it.
A couple years ago, I believe it was the Chicago Blackhawks that utilized vitamin D supplementation. Hockey players play in the winter, and there's not a lot of sunlight, and vitamin D has actually been touted either via sun exposure or via oral administration as something that can enhance athletic performance and muscle strength. Any truth to that?
Yes. I mean, this is a really interesting, you know, vitamin that's still getting a ton of attention when it comes to the research. You know, it's one thing that we looked at for a while. We looked at with the New Orleans Hornets about 5 years ago. We tested all of our players. We had 15 guys on the roster. 14 of those guys came back deficient. Like three of those guys were under.
These are the basketball players.
Yes, and of course these are, you know,
predominantly darker skinned individuals. Even in a relatively southern city, they still were D deficient.
Absolutely, because they're indoors. You know,
yeah.
You know, 82 games are indoors throughout
yeah.
the year.
And plus, if you got dark skin, you know, what's the point? You know, you got dark skin already, so why, you know, sunbathe, right?
Absolutely, because it's like SPF. It's like putting on sunscreen.
Yeah.
But, you know, there is a benefit here. I mean, we look at immune system health, we look at cancer, but from the performance side, we're starting to see, well, wait a minute. I've seen some athletes with low vitamin D correlated with low testosterone, and that's what we've seen in the literature as well.
Well, they're both steroid hormones, so they may have common pathways.
Absolutely, and we're starting to see there's possibly a benefit for vitamin D and muscle recovery. Still not a lot of data on that yet, but I think we're starting to look at vitamin D as more as performance enhancement. And it's not like you take, because I had low levels. I had my levels were under 30. Then I started taking 5,000 IUs, you know, for like a year, and now they're like 120, and my doctor's like, get off vitamin D. But I don't think I've ever...
That's a little on the high side, yeah.
It is.
Yep.
And I take a lot of stuff, and I can't say I feel any different when you take vitamins. Some people, I feel amazing, and I think that's just kind of bogus. But I think at the end of the day, it's some of these things like a vitamin D. Could it slow down bone injury? You know, we saw the New York Giants did a study.
Yeah, the stress fractures, you know, that so commonly occur because, and I've seen it actually. I've talked, you know, I go to the YMCA, and I sometimes talk to some of the other athletes there, and you know, sometimes a gal will tell me, oh, you know, I'm laid up because I have a stress fracture, and I go, gee. Maybe that's a gal who's pushing the envelope, doesn't have enough vitamin D in her system.
Yeah, I've seen that with some of the two-lane athletes as well. So anyone who has a stress fracture, we usually get their vitamin D levels tested, and 9 out of 10 times they're coming back pretty low.
Yeah. All right, this is a good point at which to complete part one of our discussion about sports medicine and sports nutrition. With today's guest. He's Tavis Piattoli. He's a registered dietitian and licensed nutritionist and coach to professional and amateur teams. And when we return, we're going to talk about specific sports supplements. We're going to dish the dirt on supplements that don't work and also talk about supplements which do in part two of today's podcast. It's Sports Nutrition. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.